This is exactly right.
Forgive me for interrupting. I'm Bridger Weiniger, host of I Said No Gifts on Exactly Right. Each week, I invite my favorite people in comedy over to chat, and they always bring a gift. We're coming up on our 200th episode, and every episode is a gem. I have welcomed all kinds of great guests, including Cola Scola, Bowen Yang, Robbie Hoffman. It goes on and on and on. And you don't want to miss the 200th episode with the great Maria Bamford. What does she bring me? Find out April 25th. New episodes every Thursday. Follow I Said No Gifts wherever you get your podcasts.
For Joe.
That's me.
Hi, Joe. I'm Kate. I'm doing the podcast. We're doing on the...
Do you know where the cemetery is?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. See those condos down there?
Yeah.
The last row this way, it's in between us and them. It's right like in their backyard.
Carrie Nolte and I really want to find Rebecca Briggs Cornell's burial site, which is just down the hill from her former home. When Rebecca died in February of 1673, she was likely to have been kept inside her home until the ground thawed. The owner of the Valley Inn restaurant, Joe Ochi, says that digging would have been almost impossible in the winter.
It's the middle of winter, and she hadn't been buried because they didn't bury anybody that died in the middle of winter back then. They couldn't.
Joe has kindly offered to give us directions.
All right, here's West Main Road.
Mm-hmm.
Here's us.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you take a left at the light,
mm-hmm.
You go all the way down here, there's a big block of mailboxes.
Mm-hmm.
That's how you know you're going the right way.
Okay.
It's in, basically in the woods.
Oh God.
Right there. It's not well kept. It should be. It's a historical cemetery.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Cornell is buried here, right?
Yeah.
It's all Cornell's. Rebecca has a plain stone. You'll never be able to tell which one's Rebecca.
Okay.
Simply because she died 100 years before they started engraving it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Thank you.
We'll see you. Thank you. I appreciate it, too.
Okay, did you get all that?
I did, and it actually matches the map that I printed out.
Good.
It's not really easy to find, but it was a short drive from the Valley Inn restaurant in Portsmouth, Rhode Island.
Hi. This is a very secret garden entrance to a cemetery.
It's nice that it's clear, though.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Here it is.
Where?
Right here.
Careful. There's a lot of branches down here.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Look how wrecked this place is.
Rhode Island Historical Cemetery.
Can you hear the crows? As if on cue.
Woo! I just got stuck.
Oh no.
So these have words. That they would not have words. The stone. Like this.
Yeah, he was saying she'll just be a stone, right?
Phoebe Cornell. Died 1830.
This is sacred.
Jonathan
Cornell.
1809. We're looking for an even older Cornell here. Rebecca, her husband Thomas Sr., or even her son, Thomas Jr.
He requested, Thomas Cornell Jr. requested to be buried next to his mother.
Okay.
But
do you think it's marked?
No, he's buried by the road.
Oh.
But it's not marked.
We're not going to be able to find him?
No. So they would refuse to bury a murderer next in a consecrated plot, which would this would be.
Stephen Cornell... 1840.
Mm-hmm.
So he should have, if he were innocent, he would be here. And Rebecca's here, we just don't know where.
No, we don't know where. She would have been buried next to Thomas Sr.
Wow, okay. Well, I wish we could see a
marker. So these are probably the original.
You can barely see Rebecca's grave marker because the slate rock is so degraded. To be honest, I'm not even sure which one it is, but she is here. We do know that.
Wouldn't you think something like this would be hers? Little tiny.
She would be next to you. So I my money would be on here.
Where?
This row.
You think so?
But so the fact that all of these are kind of laid together seems to me to indicate a family.
Yeah. Well, this is a sad little graveyard.
But how did Rebecca Cornell end up here? Was it an accident or a murder? And if it was a murder, who was her killer? Carrie Nolte helps us catch up to our story in early February of 1673.
They had found Rebecca Briggs Cornell laid on her left side, burned from her torso to the tops of her legs, and dead. They had an inquest the next day to try and see what might have caused this, you know, what are the circumstances, and it is supposed that a coal from her pipe had fallen on her and set her on fire, and she had died from that.
The coroner's jury had taken a quick look at Rebecca Cornell's body, but it wasn't an in-depth examination.
She was burned and they weren't looking. Yeah. So, I mean, I can't imagine that I also would want to look at my neighbor and family member for too long that had been, you know, burned to death.
The panel of men ruled her death as an accident, and everyone assumed that was the case for a few days.
Now, about a week later, her brother, John Briggs, wakes up and is kind of between that waking, dreaming moment and felt as though something crawled on the bed with him. And he opens his eyes and he sees his sister kind of bathed in an ethereal light. And she says, "Look how I am burned with fire." And he took this to mean that she had been deliberately burned.
John Briggs begged coroner William Ballston to retrieve her body and take a closer look, which he did. But remember, Ballston didn't appear to have any formal training in medicine of any kind.
So the thing about these colonial governments is that the coroner, the sheriff, the members of the jury, everything, that's your neighbor, that's your in-law, that's a number of different positions that person holds in your life. They are central to your life. Like, you cannot escape these interconnected webs of relationships and resentments and affiliations and good feelings and things. So everything gets layer upon layer upon layer of complexity the further into things you go.
All that's to say that the people who were determining the cause of death knew Rebecca Cornell. And they probably knew of the troubles she had had with her son before this tragedy. There's a bias there, and that could be a problem for Thomas Cornell Jr.
They had two people come and examine the body when Rebecca was first found, and they just assumed that it was an unfortunate, unhappy accident, that she perhaps had been sleeping and her pipe set her on fire and she died. Then John Briggs had his dream and they exhumed the body and two more people examined the body and found a suspicious wound.
A suspicious wound? What does that mean?
They find a suspicious wound on the upper part of her stomach.
That they hadn't noticed before?
All we know is that it is a suspicious wound. That's what was written in the record. And that is all really that they say about it. They do indicate in a couple places that they think that it was made by an iron spindle.
What's a spindle?
Spindle is one of the instruments that you use in weaving, which is one of the reasons that we think that Rebecca was a very skilled weaver.
So is it like a knitting needle almost?
It's kind of like a knitting needle.
The spindle to me is like in a weather vane. It's the little...
Mm-hmm. That's certainly what it looks like. So what I think it essentially is, it's one of those things where you drop the
thread, like you're taking fibers from wool or from flax or from cotton, and you're making thread with it.
Okay.
So you're spinning it very, very fast.
It's like a needle. It's like
it's a large needle. Yeah, like a knitting needle. And they can oftentimes be very sharp.
And the spindle Rebecca used was made of iron, so it would have been very hard and very sharp. I asked Carrie where the wound was specifically located.
It's on her torso specifically,
yeah,
right?
They said the upper part of her stomach in the record.
And it looked like something sharp.
Some sort of wound that they previously overlooked.
The jury called it a suspicious wound. The men seemed to suggest that someone had fatally stabbed Rebecca Cornell with a sharp spindle and then either set her on fire or watched her trip toward the fireplace and accidentally set herself on fire. Either way, it was murder. They were certain. Even so, Portsmouth historian Anne Burns says that their description of the wound and its potential cause was so vague that it made it almost impossible to figure out what the coroner's jury thought happened. And that's a problem. After all, couldn't the wound have also been inflicted accidentally? What if she had tripped and fallen on the spindle? Or what if it wasn't even a spindle?
They've never identified a murder weapon. Was it her pipe? Did she fall on top of the pipe she was smoking? Was it a puncture wound from the pipe?
Maybe. It was likely made of clay, which was the preferred material in Europe. It might have been sturdy enough to cause a puncture wound if she tripped and fell as she carried it. And then Anne mentions a different theory.
One of the other grandchildren said that they saw cotton around the end of a poker. The end of a poker stick. So was it that? Somebody said it. One of the not the Edward who first went into the room, but one of the other ones said it.
Was that the spindle that Carrie was talking about? Probably. But could it have also been a fireplace poker? Remember, this is likely one of the younger grandchildren, not 14-year-old Edward. He or she, the grandchild, might have been wrong. And it was very dark inside Rebecca's room.
Everybody that has a fireplace has lots of tools around it, some of them with sharp edges.
That's a good point.
So I can't say either way. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got the pokers to poke the logs. You've got different things there. So could go either way on that one. Mm-hmm. I think you could make an argument both ways.
Yeah.
But I think it's also one of the big mysteries that'll never be solved either.
The wound, if it was a wound, was described as being very small, like a needle, not thick, like the end of a fireplace poker. Let's talk about the other physical evidence. I wanted to know if they had definitively determined where the fire started.
So interestingly, when they went back to get more detail about this, we have one witness who says that there appeared to be drag marks.
Okay.
Where the coals had been dragged.
That sounds suspicious, except one of the Cornell servants had admitted that he came in and raked the coals off the body. And the witness who reported that detail was unreliable.
So could that be mistaken for something else? Because the person who is reporting about what looks like the drag marks of the coals was someone who had initially not come in with everyone who rushed in at first. He ran to the outside to make sure that the house itself was not on fire.
Okay.
Good instinct. But by the time that witness arrived, the crime scene was already contaminated by multiple people. Let's return to the positioning of the body.
The interesting thing as well is that Rebecca was found with her head towards the fireplace on her left side, her feet towards the bed. And the bed, which had valances and curtains for warmth, was singed. Part of it was burned, but not entirely.
So Rebecca's body had been severely burned by the fire. There were smoldering coals on top of her, and she was facing away from the bed. Part of the bed was also burned. I know I've said that this was the largest room in the house, but it didn't seem to be that enormous by today's standards. 17th century buildings were rarely actually large.
We have a rough estimate. I mean, they could probably do some estimation if they went into the basement of the Valley Inn and really get a sense for what the size was, but it cannot be more than 20 feet by 20 feet.
So how did the fire get to both Rebecca's body and the bed? Was she lying on it? It's hard to know. I'm definitely not an expert in fire behavior, and this isn't the only question we have.
I think that given the preponderance of what seems like coincidental providence here, it's suspicious. Why does she have a wound?
Yeah.
Why is she now burned over the wound? Why, when normally if something catches fire and there's nothing to stop it, why did it not continue to burn?
Rebecca Cornell's body had been burned beyond recognition, but other things were only lightly burned. More questions.
Personally, I think that she had been burned beyond recognition. And so there was some smoldering, and so it is as if you're burning cloth and what that sort of looks like. We don't know what the weather was like. Was it very humid? You know, were there other impediments to the burning of it? Was it timed correctly? Because these are people who knew fire, worked with fire, understood fire in a way that we don't have to because we don't use it every day.
With all of these questions, it's time to consult the experts. Our forensic chemist, who has also studied fire, says that even people who work with fire every day, like with cooking, don't always understand how it works. Rachel Burks is an associate professor of analytical chemistry at American University in Washington, D.C. She has regularly appeared on the Science Channel, so she knows how to explain forensic chemistry to a layperson like me. Thank goodness, because arson investigations are complicated.
Specifically, I'm a forensic chemist, so all of the chemicals I'm interested in are associated with misdeeds, usually, or some kind of a scandal, right? So, you know, all of the explosives, chemical weapons, drugs of abuse, which then does have overlays, of course, to public health, but mainly right in the forensic context. And then my group also does research on developing new techniques to visualize latent prints. So those are our main research areas.
We know that latent fingerprints are clues that are not visible to the eye, but they can be seen when you use fumes or certain powders. Rachel also teaches students about how fires can be used to cover up murders.
You know, as you said, fires as kind of an evidence destruction tool is very common, right? Historically, to just, you know, wipe something off, right? I mean, just completely obliterate something. And even before, well, we think of the modern advances in forensic science, so last 100, 150 years, but even previous to that, fire as a destructive tool to just not only destroy potential evidence, but to make an area inhospitable, that is a type of weapon, right? So that has been used in warfare, right? It's been used in kind of interpersonal violence, all of those things. As far as like setting people on fire, not as common as some of our other violent methods.
And it's not just fire that can destroy evidence of a crime.
The firefighter's job is not to be like, let me worry about this CSI mumbo jumbo. It's to mitigate or eliminate the fire safety threat, right? And that means you are pouring, and they're going to bring in all this contamination, pouring thousands of gallons of water through an area. And that, of course, is very destructive.
But what complicates many fire investigations are the many modern-day materials that are found in our homes that are flammable.
All kinds of furniture, even our clothing, like it's just everywhere. And that is a petroleum-based product. And with enough heat, what can happen is sometimes, right, that itself could melt. Classic is like lawn furniture, right? Or even something like a Solo cup.
Rachel says that even those red plastic cups could be problematic for arson investigations.
That can melt at high temperature and actually go into a pool. And that might, when it burns, might end up looking like, oh, someone poured an accelerant and lit it on fire. It's like, did they? Or was there something substantial of plastic that melted? And then when it was in its kind of liquidy phase, transitioned into a more fire visual burn, right? Because things will melt and then maybe it'll actually kind of combust. And that's a real challenge with fire dynamics and investigations in the modern era. You know, 200 years ago, 150 years ago or less, before the mass production of plastics, that just wasn't an issue.
If that's true, then Rebecca Cornell's case should have been relatively easy to solve. There were no plastics in 1673. So what in her room or on her could have easily heated up and combusted? Not very much. We need to look at what type of accelerant might have been used. Rachel says that most people who start fires today aren't very creative. They use the classics, gasoline or maybe diesel or maybe kerosene. Those are each very powerful accelerants. What could have been used in the Cornells' home? I asked Carrie Nolte about what she thinks happened if someone did murder Rebecca Cornell.
I think that he may have taken a piece of kindling and set her dead body on fire and set the valances on fire and staged the scene, you know, put it out and burned her in a specific way that he knew that it would just burn on her.
Rachel also says that fire is unpredictable and it's nearly impossible for a killer to control. Unlike poison, which can be administered in doses, there's little an arsonist can do to dictate where and how a fire will spread. So much of the time, staging a fire to cover up a crime scene doesn't work.
I think the thing that comes up with these types of investigations, when people use destructive techniques, they think the fire will consume all. And that simply isn't the case. Fire is a combustion reaction. No chemical reaction is 100% efficient and going in the forward, like all producing 100%. They're just not. They are not.
But couldn't the arsonist just add more fuel? Not exactly. Rachel has a crazy story that illustrates why more fuel isn't usually the determining factor in whether a fire is successful. It's more the combustible reaction.
There was a particular video, I think it was during the pandemic, where someone tried to burn another person's car. And I'm watching this video going, yikes, is that they take a gas can, right, a red, bright red that we've all kind of seen or maybe used, leans all the way into the back seat. And that's where I'm like, pours the gas in the back.
Rachel says that the woman thought she needed to light the liquid gas. Big mistake.
So this person leans all the way into the back seat, lights it. But what really actually is burning is the vapor. That's what is the particle to particle burn. Like that in a hot day, right? That gasoline in an effectively pretty enclosed car, you've made almost like a little bomb.
Before the woman could reach the liquid with her hand, she lit the gas vapors.
And so luckily the force of that, because it's a rapidly expanding gas, pushes her back out into the car that's next to the car she's trying to destroy, it looks like. Luckily, her injuries are minor. And that's the other thing people don't get, is that it's really probably the vapor that's going to be more dangerous and what's actually going to cause the burn, not so much the bulk fuel.
Fire as a weapon seems a little like poison. There's a complicated chemistry to it, so it's really hard to get right.
Not only the bulk, the material, the density, there are certain things that are, you know, just more flammable than others. Like you sprinkling on a little gas, it may not be it, right? It may not be the right oxygen ratio. Even though there is some level of fire, you might need more fuel. You might need more oxygen. Like that's the complicated chemistry. And sometimes I think it's just evil luck.
But what about Rebecca Cornell's case? Why was she specifically burned in certain areas? And if it was arson, wouldn't the whole house catch on fire?
Depending on where she was in the room, you know, her clothing, her bedding area, it could have actually been quite contained. And I'm going to have to be a little bit graphic here. But that human fat, the oil, that can actually serve as a type of burning fuel. And sometimes the most destroyed areas can be those that are like where areas of fat can kind of collect on the average human body.
So it sounds like Rebecca's body could have served as its own fuel. And another thing, Rebecca is described as wearing boots. That's how Thomas identified her. Now, Rachel says that this detail makes a big difference.
Sometimes there are areas that might be seen to be protected because they're also covered up by more sturdy materials. You know, if she had like a quality boot on, leather, you know, something treated, maybe weathered in some way, she could have had completely intact lower limbs.
One more detail we can't forget. Remember that Rebecca's daughter-in-law, Sarah Earle, who couldn't stand her mother-in-law, told investigators in a statement that it was, quote, marvelous that the cotton on Rebecca's clothing had not burned, while the wool did burn.
Why is that marvelous?
Probably so they could recoup some of the cloth, and also because you would think that everything would burn. Because we're talking about, like, you would inherit someone's clothing once they died, because that is how precious and just completely scarce these items are. So that she could salvage anything from this would be fantastic.
For a moment, let's set aside how incriminating and weird Sarah's marvelous comment was. There's something else important here: how different types of materials burn. And again, our forensic chemist, Rachel Burke, has an explanation.
She somehow ignites, or her fabric ignites, and it starts to burn. Somehow, maybe the curtains, not quite sure, right? And we don't even know if it happened in that order. Then the curtains light up. That's almost a second that could potentially have been like, here's this fire. Heat transfer or whatever goes to that material. And then what that material, the weave, is going to matter. Was there some type of treatment on it? What was the exact, even 100% cotton? It doesn't go up like in the movies, of like, right?
If Rebecca had been alive when she was on fire, why didn't she scream?
You went immediately to a level of panic, which, you know, heart rate. Maybe you're not thinking clearly. Like, you know, in your scenario, you don't have her calling out. The house is full, right? And that's the thing, is we don't sometimes act rationally. And we keep saying that, like, you know, oh, it's only this deep of water. Why didn't they stand up? Because people in distress don't act, quote, as rational human beings sometimes.
In the end, Rachel Burke says it might simply have been a terrible accident. It seems to be a very logical explanation for all of this.
She could have died of natural causes, fell off her chair. She could have had a massive coronary. She could have been, if she was ill, you know, she reported that, you know, she told a friend she wasn't feeling well and she didn't want to eat. Could have been some kind of gastrointestinal distress, which is a manifestation of all kinds of stuff, including poisonings. And I'm talking food poisoning too, right? And so, you know, I don't think it's unreasonable to also assert that she could have died of natural causes.
That does seem simple. But this is tenfold. And if you know how these stories go, you know there's always something more there. If you were to rank things that are important to you, where would you rank sleep? Sleep for me ranks about number 3. If I don't get enough sleep, I am cranky, I am more hungry than usual. It's not a good situation. If sleep isn't high on your priority list, that might be because you didn't know there is a direct correlation between sleeping well and feeling your best mentally and physically. Of course, getting enough sleep can sometimes feel like an impossible task, but with Beam's Dream Powder, you'll have help falling asleep and staying asleep. Beam's Dream Powder is a science-backed hot cocoa mix that comes in delicious flavors like chocolate peanut butter, cinnamon cocoa, and sea salt. In a clinical study, 93% of participants reported Dream Powder helped them get better sleep. Better sleep has never tasted better, and all the flavors are sugar-free. I tried the chocolate peanut butter flavor. Peanut butter is one of my most favorite things, so I was really happy that it was an available flavor. I mixed it with milk and it tasted really smooth, like a hot cocoa. And one of the nice things is that it kept me asleep all night long, which is really unusual. I have a lot of anxiety. I worry about work. And so I wake up in the middle of the night and I just haven't once I started using Beam. Find out why Forbes and the New York Times are talking about Beam and why it's trusted by the world's top athletes and business professionals. If you want to try Beam's best-selling Dream Powder, you'll get up to 40% off for a limited time when you go to shopbeam.com/wicked and use wicked at checkout. That's shopbeam.com/wicked and use code wicked for up to 40% off. If you're an avid Exactly Right podcast listener, chances are you've heard me or one of my network colleagues talk about Rocket Money. And while you might know that Rocket Money helps you cancel unwanted subscriptions, you might not know that they also offer personal financial services. The once mysterious world of finance is at your fingertips in the easy-to-use Rocket Money app. Once you sign up, all your expenses are imported into their dashboard. There, you can monitor your spending and implement new habits so you can meet your goals. That dream vacation could finally be a reality. Rocket Money even offers a concierge who will try to negotiate with your phone or cable providers to make sure you're getting the best rates. Join the more than 5 million Rocket Money users who have saved $500 million in canceled subscriptions. When customers use all of the app's features, that comes to about $740 of annual savings per member. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wicked. That's rocketmoney.com/wicked. rocketmoney.com/wicked. April is Earth Month, and what better way to celebrate than by bringing some greenery into your space? And there's no easier way to do that than with fast-growing trees. They're the largest online nursery in the U.S. with over 10,000 different plants and over 2 million happy customers. From fruit trees to palm trees and evergreens to houseplants, Fast Growing Trees has something for everyone and every climate. And they'll deliver everything to your door in just 1 to 2 days. Fast Growing Trees is truly the easiest and most convenient way to bring new life into your space, just in time for spring. I got a tree from Fast Growing Trees that I am absolutely in love with. I'm a huge maple fan. I've mentioned this before. And I planted this guy, this Autumn Blaze tree, which I just thought, is this tree going to do well? I mean, it came in the mail. What's going to happen? And it is spectacular. It is growing. It's got leaves all over the place. They look healthy. I had an arborist come and look at it, and he said it looks great. So I couldn't be more pleased with this product. This spring, Fast Growing Trees has the best deals online with up to half off select plants. And listeners of our podcast get an additional 15% off their first purchase when using the code TENFOLD at checkout. That's an additional 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com when you use the code TENFOLD at checkout. fastgrowingtrees.com and use code TENFOLD. Offer is valid for a limited time. Terms and conditions apply. We've been talking with our forensic chemist, Rachel Burks, and she suggested that, despite the strange circumstances around her burning, it's possible that Rebecca Cornell did die of natural causes.
Sometimes people will be like, oh, it must have been burning for a long time. No, it could have just been that much energy, just the right combination of energy, oxygen, and fuel. It's not always a matter of time. It's a matter of the ratio. It could actually be a very short amount of time.
Rachel wishes we had more information. Me too. About rugs in the room, about the size of the room, how insulated it was, about the exact size of the fireplace, the drafts of air that night. All of those things could give us more definitive answers. Without those details, it's just speculation, which is always dangerous. Rachel thinks it's possible that Rebecca could have fallen as she was dying near the fireplace and her clothes then caught on fire. But, Rachel says, it also could have been murder, with the fire used to cover it up.
See, and we don't know how she fell, right? And that's the thing, too, is like,
there are so many questions about, you know, there are other reasonable options. And I would say in addition to maybe some other mode was used and then fire was used as a cover up. That's a distinct possibility. You've mentioned that.
Back to Rebecca's body. Gloria Schmidt has questions about that wound. The matrons had undressed her, cleaned her, and then redressed her right after her death. Rebecca had been totally stripped down, but the women didn't report any kind of wound at the time. And that seems odd to both Gloria and me.
Why wouldn't the women have seen it when they first took care of her body? Maybe they didn't think it was anything. Maybe it was something small enough that it could have been from anything.
And remember, Rebecca Cornell was likely being kept covered inside a warm house. Decomposition would have progressed much more quickly than if she were outside. John Briggs had that dream a few days after her death, giving the body plenty of time to degrade.
But it might not have been there at the first go, because you've got decomposition happening, you know, that there wouldn't be any preservation of the body, no embalming when they're, you know, looking at it. But I don't think it's a very large hole. And it's just something that is, you know, above the stomach, or that's the way they describe it. So I think they think that it's small enough that something sharp might have caused it, but they didn't see it when they were preparing the body. So that makes me dubious.
Valley Inn restaurant owner Joe Ochi says that the coroner's jury in 1673 was on a mission, thanks to the dream that Rebecca's brother had.
They already, as far as they knew, had a sign from a Rebecca because she appeared to her brother. So they, in my mind, would be looking for a second sign. Mm-hmm. There it was. So that and the conjecture of her and her son not getting along, you just add it all up and he's the main suspect.
Between the newly discovered wound, the ghost in the dream, and the bad feelings between mother and son, Thomas Cornell became the prime suspect in what was most certainly a murder, according to people in Portsmouth. But this definitely wasn't an open-and-shut case. Thomas's version of events was consistent. It was an accident, he said, not murder. He had argued quite a bit with his mother, he admitted, but he would have never killed her.
So he doesn't change his testimony, you know, between the coroner's jury and the trial. His deposition is almost word for word.
And yet, Thomas Cornell Jr. would soon go on trial for her murder. I asked Gloria if the coroner's jury had spoken to Sarah Earle before they issued an official ruling of murder. Her statements had seemed pretty concerning to me, and she didn't appear to be grieving.
No, she's not going before the coroner's jury. And the two people that went before the coroner's jury was Thomas and this Henry Strait that had gone in with him.
Carrie Nolte, like the rest of us, has quite a few questions.
One thing that's questionable to me is, again, why did no one hear anything?
Mm-hmm. Why didn't she? She's on fire.
Smell anything? And how did she burn enough that she was unrecognizable in that time? Because her son was in there for an hour beforehand, talking with her. And then they went to dinner. And how long does that take? Certainly not very long.
Carrie says that the timing, if this were murder, seems odd.
So how long was she burning? And how fast? And if some of her clothing didn't burn, how long was she on fire for? So she was apparently burned from the top of her head to the top of her legs. So my question is, how does that happen? What is the rate of burn? And then why would some parts of her burn and not other parts of her? And I don't know enough about, you know, fire and things that are flammable and the rate of burn.
Yeah, neither do I, but most of their clothing was flammable.
Very flammable.
Yeah.
These are all questions with no real answers without modern forensics, of course. Carrie and Joe and I talk about the mechanics of how the fire might have started.
The idea that nothing would happen. I mean, unless she had a heart attack and fell over, but why would most of her be burned and not just a spot of her, even if a spark flew from the fire and lit part of her on, you know, ablaze? It's just a little beyond the circumstances as they were described, are a little beyond belief for me.
Well, logically, if she did fall, more to the top of her would be burned.
Sure.
So you can make an argument both ways, I think.
I would love to hear a scientist who is versed in these kinds of things to kind of explain, you know, the rate of burn. How fast does a human body burn? What parts burn faster than other parts? Why would there be scorch marks on the bed? You know, what does this scene look like to a forensic person now, to someone who investigates fires? Because to me, it seems the totality of the events as they seem to transpire leaves me with more questions than seems reasonable for an accident.
Right. That's reasonable doubt. In February of 1673, just about everyone in Portsmouth seemed to be suspicious of Thomas Cornell thanks to the new evidence of murder. This is all despite the fact that Thomas seemed to be respected overall. Portsmouth historian Anne Burns questions the motives of just about everyone in this case.
The man that her brother, John Briggs, who had the apparition, what did he have to gain? Who got the property after if his nephew was deposed? What did he stand to gain? Like, did he get the property afterwards? Like, you know, like, did he hope to get the property afterwards? Man, how do you know he wasn't making the whole thing up, right? So he had so much credibility, John Briggs had so much credibility. And apparently the status quo at the time was not to question people that had high standing in the community.
Now we're back to motive. Why are so many people raising the alarm specifically about Thomas? Why not someone else in the house, like Sarah Earle?
Everybody is placing Thomas Cornell in the room. Are they totally dismissing the idea of an accident happening at all? Because this happened all the time. People set themselves on fire.
Yeah, yeah. I do. I think that John Briggs planted the seed that there may have been foul play, and they reopened the case, found that wound, and then just started talking to people. I don't know if people came forward, if the constable went out and found people to depose. I think it sounds like it was pretty common knowledge that there was a lot of tension amongst the household, the adults in the household. So that probably wasn't new news. And they ran with it. But it's like, it's gossip.
And remember, Rebecca had admitted to her daughter that she was horribly depressed. Might she have taken her own life? Meanwhile, Thomas Cornell cried to anyone who would listen that he was innocent. And maybe some people would change their mind. But then a surprise witness offered investigators a deposition that would shake Thomas's case. It turns out that Rebecca Cornell wasn't just a victim of elder abuse, according to her friends. She was planning to leave Thomas and Sarah's home because she was also afraid for her life. On the next episode of Tenfold More Wicked on Exactly Right.
When you look at the depositions, most of them are talking about his not treating her as well as he could.
Well, and obviously, if you're going to hit someone or inflict violence on someone, you're more likely to do it on your mother, because she's going to be weaker than you or weaker than your other parent.
Part of what gets them to indict Thomas is the spectral evidence that John Briggs has, where his sister comes to him and says, "Look how I am burned with fire."
even in the late 20th century, you had arson investigators with very little training saying, the fire speaks to me, you know, and using this very like witchy cosmic language around their skills.
And it just seems so shocking that that would be considered evidence, that that would somehow, like, this person got indicted. I'm like, what?
If you love true crime, check out my books, American Sherlock and All That Is Wicked. I also have an audiobook called The Ghost Club. I can't wait to tell you the real story about the world's most famous ghost hunter, who was the head of the world's most famous ghost club, and how he investigated England's most famous haunted house. This has been an Exactly Right Tenfold More Media production. Producer Jason Whaling, senior producer Alexis Amorosi, consulting producer Kyle Ryan, researcher Nicole Brown, sound designer Eric Friend, additional sound design by Nicholas Moonies, composer Curtis Heath, artwork Nick Toga, executive producers Georgia Hardstark, Karen Kilgariff, and Danielle Kramer. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Tenfold More Wicked.